calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, should a single corporation, or even a bunch of corporations, or even a class of companies, be allowed to essentially take over communities, take over local politics? How much power should we allow large corporations to have? Zachary Corser is with us. He's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, the website. And Zachary, you wrote a piece called Walmart and the Politics of American Retail, in which you seem to be, well, rather than putting words in your mouth, let me just let you lay it out.
Well, I decided to put Walmart sort of in context of the history of American retail and found that there's a cycle that repeats itself and has been repeating itself for over 100 years now, where someone will come along with a new and innovative way of retail that usually ends up offering more and better consumer goods at lower prices, but at the same time pushing out sort of older, smaller ways of doing retail. You know, sort of, you know, for a long time in America, up until the late 19th century, retailing was sort of a very small, localized affair. You know, individual shops that maybe carried only one or two lines of goods supplied by a network of wholesalers. Probably the first major innovation to happen was the Sears Roebuck Company, who offered a wider selection
with their catalog. You could even buy a house from Sears.
You could buy just virtually anything from Sears. And this really put a lot of small businesses out of business, in rural areas especially. And it caused a backlash, understandably so, because, you know, a lot of people were being put out of business because they found themselves unable to compete with Sears' size, but also with, you know, their service and the kind of goods they offered and their prices. And it reached such a fever pitch at some point that in small towns, independent retailers would get together and organize Sears catalog burnings to sort of, you know, protest the size of Sears and try to exhort people to shop in their own communities rather than shopping at Sears.
Right, and this kind of reached a crescendo in the 1930s with JCPenney in the state of Florida. I'm assuming you're familiar with that Supreme Court case, JCPenney versus Florida.
Well, there's several Supreme Court cases, you know, starting really all the way back in the teens and 20s, relating more specifically to chain stores like Walgreens, Woolworths, the A&P grocery chain, all basically trying to, you know, question chain stores and the ability to discount goods.
Well, or really what it was the chain stores were questioning local communities' ability or right or authority to say no to the chain stores. And that's what the court ruled in 36. They said that JCPenney was protected under the 14th Amendment against discrimination as a person.
But nonetheless, people were able to react against chain stores democratically. That there was a cry that went up saying that, you know, similar to the cries that are going up against Walmart right now, saying that chain stores were unfairly competing against local merchants, that they did not benefit their communities because all the profits went to, you know, large cities like New York and Chicago. They complained that they did not pay their employees enough. There was a huge campaign called the Trade at Home campaign, where local merchants would have consumers sign up basically to promise to only shop and frequent independent retailers.
Right. Now, Zachary Corser, we've also had in this country, if you want to look at cycles, you can look at cycles of the rise and fall of labor unions, for example, as well. Just because something has happened before doesn't mean that it's legitimate that it be happening now. Are you suggesting that because in the past communities have said, hey, we don't want to have our community wiped out by Woolworths or JCPenney, we would like to keep our local businesses, that we should therefore be now saying, you know, it's okay if Walmart comes in and wipes out our local businesses, even if the majority of the people in the community don't want it?
I think the point is that the Sears Roebuck Company and the chain stores didn't wipe out communities. I think what I'm saying is that I think these new retail leviathans tend to come in and frighten people, you know, because we as Americans wear two hats. You know, we're consumers and we're always seeking the best price, but we're also citizens with protected rights and political beliefs. And when things in the economy change drastically, sometimes, you know, we can react against those and sort of, you know, feel powerless against some kind of retail force.
Jeremy, you're getting very rhetorical here. I mean, what is...
I don't think I'm getting rhetorical.
Name a major community in the United States where you can drive down the street and see more than 1% or more than 5% of the businesses actually owned and operated by local people. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't exist in the United States anymore. It hasn't, by and large, since the 1980s.
Well, Tom, I'm not being rhetorical, because what I'm getting at is that the decisions we make about how we live our lives are not simply a product of supply and demand. They're also a product of democratic choice. And I think Americans have largely, both economically and democratically, by and large, have chosen the sort of big box model of Walmart. I mean, there's a price to be paid for Main Street America. There's a price to be paid as far as paying more for consumer goods. There's a price to be paid as far as convenience, as far as, you know, being able to park someplace or to being able to take public transport or what have you. And Americans, by and large, have chosen the big box model. And
are Americans making that choice because they understand that model, or are they making that choice because they don't? I mean, I think that if you ask most Americans, do you realize that if you spend a dollar in a Walmart, what's going to come back to your community is 6 cents, whereas if you spend a dollar at a local store, what's going to come back to that community is 60 cents, that they'll say, gee, I had no idea.
I'm not making a normative judgment about the choice, but I'll say this, putting it in context of, say, Walmart again. Before Sam Walton died in the late 80s, early 90s, he made an attempt to try to rescue a lot of American manufacturing jobs by having a Buy America program.
Sure.
And the program was a failure. Why? Because people didn't care. They would much rather shop at any of Walmart's competitors and save, you know, 1, 5, 10% on products that were produced in China or wherever.
Yeah, I understand. Which brings us to the larger question, which is, at what point do we say an individual corporation or a retailer, whether it was Sears in 1890 or whether it's Walmart in 2005, at what point do we say, enough already, you have enough power? You have the Walton family now generating an $8 billion a year profit, throwing money around in Washington, D.C. You've got a huge corporation, well, funding you. I mean, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, and foundations from wealthy families, families of great wealth, founding, essentially front groups who are out promoting this sort of thing. At what point do we say, no, let's go back to enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act? There, we have a history in the United States of pushing back against this kind of thing.
Well, two things. One, I've received no money from Walmart. CEI has received no money from Walmart. I'm just an independent scholar looking at the question. Secondly, you know, how big is too big?
But CEI is heavily funded by large corporations and the benefactors of large corporate wealth, and you and I both know that. I mean,
but not Walmart.
But you're using Walmart as an example. I mean, and we're both using Walmart as an example.
We are both using Walmart as an example. How big is too big? I guess it's a choice that we make as a people when we decide that Walmart ceases to be a positive influence on the U.S. economy.
Why the U.S. economy? Why not local economies?
Well, local economies are part of the U.S. economy. And if people are willing to make the choice for themselves, I'm not suggesting that people should accept Walmart as some sort of untrammeled good without sort of looking into it for themselves. But what I will say is, having looked at the numbers myself, having looked at studies done, for instance, in Iowa about Walmart's effect on local communities, what you find is that overall in America, there's a consolidation of the retail market within sort of large big box retailers, and that ultimately who benefits from that are consumers with lower prices.
No. Well, okay, yes. People get to buy cheaper stuff. And people are making less money as a consequence of it. You get a whole lot of these retailers bringing all this stuff in from overseas, and which is really, I understand, a separate discussion, but nonetheless, bringing all this stuff in. We get cheaper goods, and we get lower wages. I think the average American, if they were told, hey, you're going to have to buy from a local company, and it's going to be made in the United States, it's going to cost you 20% more, but guess what? Your paycheck's going to be 50% more, would say, that's fine. I mean, let's go back to the way it was under Eisenhower, under the Republicans during the 1950s.
Well, you know, that's another reason why it's important to look back. You know, these chain stores in the 20s and 30s, they didn't pay much either. Retail has never been a sector of the economy that has paid much in the way of wages or benefits. These are not great jobs.
They were considered entry level jobs by and large. You know, working at the Walmart, at the Walgreens or whatever. We had an industrial infrastructure at that time,
right,
too.
GM
was the largest employer in America. Things have changed.
I would say that Walmart actually helps drive up productivity, and it helps stretch people's dollars who need them most.
And it's driving down wages.
It is driving down
wages across the United States because it's setting the new floor for wages as the largest employer in the United States.
I don't think they drive down wages in any way that outweighs the benefits they offer as far as lower prices, productivity, and keeping inflation low.
Walmart workers make on average $3 an hour less than union supermarket jobs, $2 an hour less than all supermarket jobs, $1 per hour less than the average retail wage. They are driving down the floor.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics measures the average wage for all of retail in 2004 as $10.25 an hour. Walmart pays $9.70 an hour. They're very much on par with the rest of the retail market.
Right, driving us down. Well, good conversation. Zachary Corser, CEI.org, the website for more information. Zachary, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. It is 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman, the no boring zone. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, where you get the latest iPods, smalldog.com. If you're looking for Christmas gifts and things like that, give them a call, 1-800-511-MAX. Or if you want to give somebody some really cool French wine for Christmas, they even have gift packs now. Check out the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECOWINE, or ecowine.com online, the Organic Wine Company. Welcome back to our program. Walmart workers, studies in Iowa have shown that small towns lose up to 47% of their retail trade after 10 years of a Walmart store moving in nearby. Walmart real estate manager Jeff Doss spoke of an off-sided remark by company founder Sam Walton that Walmart would not build stores in towns if residents did not want them. Were that the case, he said, we'd never build a store anywhere. Yeah. Walmart negatively impacts the environment, traffic, and sprawl. In October of 2004, the United States sued Walmart for violating the Clean Water Act in 9 states, calling for penalties of over $3 million and changes to Walmart's building codes. Study of estimated additional driving costs of supercenters in the San Francisco Bay Area estimated a cost of up to $256 million in additional costs to the community for infrastructure repair and environmental degradation. And as I said in the last segment, they are basically driving down the income of Americans. And in part, as again, I think it's so important to keep in mind, this isn't just about Walmart being, you know, nasty, evil company. By the way, the stats I just shared with you are from wakeupwalmart.com. Walmart is just a symptom of a larger cancer that is eating out America and has been for many years, and we've been seeing the ebb and flow of it right from the founding of this country. I mean, the original rebellion in 1773, the Boston Tea Party in the winter of 1773 against the British East India Company, was against the Walmartization of the tea business in the United States, where the colonists said enough. Because the British East India Company had just gotten this huge tax cut. It's called the Tea Act of 1773. A lot of people think the Tea Act was a tax increase. It was a tax cut. Yes, my friends, it was a tax cut. And it was a tax cut specifically for Walmart. Well, excuse me, not Walmart, for the British East India Company, the Walmart of their day. And the colonists, most of whom were small business entrepreneurs, said if this company gets this multi-million-dollar tax cut on tea, they're going to be able to bring tea in at such low prices that we can't compete. We'll get put out of business. They're going to wipe us out. And we had no say in this tax cut. And therefore, you've got this problem of taxation without representation. Seriously, no taxation. Well, there was also the Stamp Act. That was a tax increase. He had both. He had a tax increase, and then he had a tax cut, the Tea Act, both in 1773. And the colonists were just flipped out about it, and so they threw the tea in Boston Harbor. They said, enough. We're not going to have it. One study, Southern California municipalities estimated that for every dollar decreases in wages in the Southern California economy, $2.08 in spending was lost. The $1 decrease plus another $1.08 in indirect multiplier impacts. This is what happens when big out-of-state corporations come into local communities. It's not just that every night at midnight a button gets pushed and all the local money goes like that, you know, a giant vacuum cleaner sucking it up into a bank in Bentonville, Arkansas in the case of Walmart, or Chicago in the case of McDonald's or whatever it may be. It's not just that all the dollars go out of the local community. Some of them do come back in the form of wages and in the form of taxes, of course, which these companies like to tout. But what doesn't stay in the community is local support services. The local CPAs are not being hired. The local attorneys are not being hired. The local architects are not being hired. All the traditional support services that a local business has, they're not being hired. And those people then buy things in the community. And so there's this multiplicative effect. There's also the fact that if a bank takes in a dollar, they can loan out actually more than a dollar in mortgages and things. And so if a company is banking with a local bank, as they deposit money into that local bank, that money becomes available to the local community to be loaned out to local small businesses. And it grows. It grows the community. Whereas if it all goes out of state or if it all goes out of the community, it doesn't happen. It doesn't have an opportunity to grow. So there have been many attempts historically in the United States to say, enough. We want local communities want to have the right to have some protection over their community. There are some efforts to do this, including local currencies. When I lived in Vermont, we had the Green Mountain Dollars. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do this, but the number one way is for local people to have the power to say no to non-local businesses. And not have to do it like here in Oregon right now. They're having to do it with traffic laws. They're trying to keep out Walmarts from two different places with traffic laws. I mean, it's silly that they should have to do that. They should simply be able to say, no, we want local businesses to do this, or at least we want small businesses to be able to do this so that we can have competition once again in the United States. Because these very, very large businesses at their foundation are anti-competitive. That's why Senator Sherman introduced the Sherman Antitrust Act back in 1881, and it still stands today. We need a fundamental, if we are going to shift from a manufacturing economy to a service economy, as we seem to have already done or are rapidly doing, then we need to shift the rules of the game as well. So, because, you know, otherwise we're going to end up with basically a bunch of wage slaves to China. That's the direction we're going. 27 minutes past the hour.
800-297-3019. That's 800-297-3019.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Here in the city, shrouded in smoke, 10 million people this morning awoke to a future of cancer, industrial disease. So let's build some more suburbs and buy SUVs. Cut down the mountains, burn all the coal, and put all the money in a humongous bowl. They'll call it progress and they'll blame it on you to end life as we know it, to enrich the few. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person, and dare to say, no, don't think so. Welcome back to the radio home of democracy. Today, by the way, the anniversary of the infamous attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
At Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that attack occurred December 7th, 1941. Victory in Europe Day, May 8th, 1945. Victory in Japan Day, the Hiroshima blast, August 9th. The treaty was signed August 15th, 1945. So if you do the math on that, you see, okay, the Pearl Harbor was in December of 41. Now let's flip it to today. 9/11 was in September of 2001. So this is really easy because they both end with one, right? So you got December. So it was later in the year. Pearl Harbor happened later in the year than 9/11 happened. 9/11 happened in September. Pearl Harbor happened in December. And World War II ended 1945, and this is the 05 year. Hey, it's really easy to do the math on this. Pearl Harbor ended, World War II ended in August. August 15th of 1945, and August 15th kind of came and went here in 2005, and then September, and then October, and then November, and now here we are in December. So it's been a longer period of time from 9/11 to today that we've had this so-called war on terror than it took Franklin Roosevelt to fight World War II and win it. Once again demonstrating Franklin Roosevelt competent, George Bush incompetent. Very simple, very simple. So anyhow, our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartmann.com. However you spell it will get you there, although the correct spelling is T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's. But nonetheless, we've got all the misspellings. And you can get there, drop in, click the live chat button if you want to participate in our blog. There's over 100,000 messages there now. You can post messages for posterity, sound off on a whole variety of topics. You can do that as well. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. Kenneth in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Kenneth, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
I am just great, but I'll get better. What's up, Kenneth?
You can hear me real bit?
I can, just fine.
I just wanted two comments. I want a Walmart. They got so big to the point that they went and petitioned the Department of Transportation to change our the service out here in the trucking industry to allow them to, if we sit on that dock for too long, we could charge detention time and stuff like that. So they wanted us to give them a four-hour window on our own time so that they wouldn't have to charge us, wouldn't have to pay us out detention time.
Incredible.
Stuff like that.
Were they successful?
Huh?
Were they successful?
No, you had a lot of groups fought against that. I'm not sure if they're still trying to put up that fight, but they actually were trying to change our hours of service out here.
Yeah, so Walmart has become so powerful that it's even affecting the trucking industry.
Oh, yeah, and another couple of companies like Davies, Snyder, Swift is like your top three major companies out here as far as in the trucking industry. And what happened is they got so big that they actually influenced rates out here in the trucking industry. So if tomorrow they say, well, look, we don't care what the price of fuel is, we just want to start hauling loads for $1 a mile,
yeah,
it would just wipe out all independence out here. We wouldn't be able to compete,
Right.
And we're having a hard time as it is right now.
That's amazing. Well, Kenneth, I wish you well. I mean, this, again, is the problem of huge corporations having so much power politically, economically, which then translates into political power because we have this bizarre system in the United States where corporations are considered persons, and because they don't have mouths like you and I do, their dollars are considered their form of speech. Thanks a lot for the call, Kenneth. Great to hear from you. Don in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're live and on the air.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am great. What's up?
Hey, let me tell you, happy holidays, first off.
Well, thank you, and the same to you.
I want to weigh in on the Walmart thing.
Mm-hmm.
For starters, I have my own problems with Walmart. We see a lot around here of eminent domain involved with Walmart.
Where local communities are taking land in order to
sell it to Walmart.
To give it to Walmart, yeah.
Dollars. Yeah. And I believe...
That's happening in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I believe the basic... right of freedom is private property.
It's certainly one of them.
And you take that away, and you're losing a lot.
Yeah.
But
as we saw with the Kelo decision in the Supreme Court, I mean, this is just a disaster.
Sure. But I would also like to say that, we keep hearing these things about Walmart paying $3 an hour less. And you mentioned it yourself a little while back, about 15 minutes back or so, about entry-level jobs.
Yeah, when I was a kid, you know, I worked at a place as a waiter. I worked at a gas station. I changed tires and I pumped gas. I did aluminum siding. I put aluminum siding on houses. I mean, I did a lot of things when I was working my way through school. I ended up working as a DJ and did that for years. And other than the DJ job, those were all considered entry level jobs. Those are the things that teenagers did to put themselves through college or put themselves through high school or whatever. And eventually you got a real job, a real union job, you know, working at Oldsmobile or something. And, now the real job is at Walmart, working for a pay wage that puts you into the poverty line.
Well, you know what, here's what I wanted to call in about is I kind of blame the union a little bit for that.
How?
You have things like the service workers union now.
Right.
Where they're not telling you, hey, look at this as an entry-level job, you're going to move on. They're telling you, hey, stick it out, go on strike, we'll get you more money, we'll get you more health care.
And in many cases, they actually are. You've got people over at Costco who are making $30,000, $40,000 a year working at Costco. That's a middle-class income.
We have Giant Eagles here. People at Giant Eagle making $30,000, $40,000 a year.
Right. So,
but they're few and far between.
The average person
working there is probably not breaking 12.
Yeah.
But they're telling them, hey, stick it out, we'll get you more money. And when they should be telling them, you know what, look at this as entry level and move on.
Well, but see, the problem is there's no place to move on to. I mean, that's the fundamental and flawed reality of America right now is that because conservative economics, because of these insane trade policies that were signed off on by the Reagans and the Clintons and the Bushes all together.
But
because of these policies, these jobs just don't exist in the United States anymore, or they're existing in smaller and smaller numbers, and so these are what used to be entry level jobs are becoming the jobs, and so I salute SEIU and other organizations that are unionizing these folks. I mean, they're making the best of a bad situation, but we have to fix that bad situation at the level of national politics.
I'll agree with you to a point, but I think what happens is, I think they start to just stand for it.
No, I'm telling you, Don, if you try to blame the unions for this situation, it's just like blaming a woman who's been raped for wearing a pretty dress. It is, you are blaming the victims.
No, I'm not blaming the victim, but what I'm saying is don't always try to be a victim. You know what I mean?
How is that any different than saying,
let's put it this way. If you're working at Walmart and you're making $8 an hour and you haven't put a job application in anywhere in a year, you're not a victim.
Well, yeah, I'm not going to disagree with you totally on that, Don, but I will say that a lot of people probably haven't put in that job application anywhere in a year because there just aren't jobs out there.
I understand what you're saying.
Both of us don't like the word victim, but the reality is that we are all participants in an economy, and we are all victims of the Bush-Clinton economy that we've got here.
I agree with you. We run a small business ourselves. And we try as much as possible to do business with local businesses and avoid the big boxes and the Walmarts.
But see, ultimately, it's got to go beyond that. Like I keep saying, shaming people is not a national industrial policy. I'm not going to criticize them. When I lived in Vermont, we had to buy new bedding. It was just new pillows and sheets. Literally, every store within 100 miles of where we lived had been put out of business by the local Walmart, and I had to go to a Walmart to buy a pillow.
What choice
do I have?
Right where we're at here, we have we do a lot with hardware.
Yeah.
We have a construction-type business. We deal with a lot of local hardware stores, which are still
in
quite a bit.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We have two babies as well. When it comes to buying diapers, there's really not another place to go.
Yeah, and that's the problem. We need a national industrial policy. We need to be dealing with this at the level of policy, at the level of politics, rather than blaming the consumers, or for that matter, blaming the unions.
No, I'm not blaming the union. Don't misunderstand me. Okay. I think a lot of people are sitting around listening to false promises that can't be kept.
Yeah, I don't disagree. Don, thanks a lot for the call. Pete, I'm going to sneak in here real quick. You got to take a break real quickly, but Pete in Queens, New York.
Hey, Tom. First of all, I just want to compliment you quick on your book, What Would Jefferson Do? It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Everybody should pick it up.
Thank you very much, Pete.
The problem with Walmart, I just want to, quickly, Hannity was saying how Walmart's such a fabulous store, its prices are so cheap. Meanwhile, he doesn't realize that the prices, might be fabulously cheap, but they treat their workers terribly.
Yeah, well, he does realize it, Pete. I guarantee you he realizes it, and he goes along with it because it's part of the conservative agenda.
You know, I don't know if he's so foolish or it's just a matter of that
he knows which side his bread is buttered on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Pilgrims in the parking lot, arteries clogged with blood clots, pushing through the aisles of department stores. Neon crosses and Christmas lights, credit card debts and brand new bikes. The holidays are here and we're still at war.
Welcome back, my friends.
The rabbi reads from the testament, the banker gazes at the year's investment, salvation Santa solicits for the poor. Deception of democracy, the philandering's a faux foreign policy, the holidays are here and we're still at war.
It's 9 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. By the way, coming up in the next hour, we're going to be talking with Alec Dubrow, the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association. Our union is supporting free trade in order to expand their membership outside the United States. We're going to be talking with Kevin Knoblaw, the president of the union, concerned scientists about what's the world going to look like? With global warming, are we going to see more Katrinas? How bad is it going to get? How bad might it get here? And in our third hour of the program today, this is going to be a hoot. Our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, we're going to get Rob Bresnion, the world famous, is not an exaggeration, astrologer and author of Pronoia, which he says is the antidote for paranoia. And we're going to ask him, what do the stars hold for us this week? You know, what's the deal? What's going on? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Todd in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Todd, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about the Walmart thing, and I actually want to blame the consumers. I think instead of an industrial policy, we need to talk to consumers and make them aware that their policies or their purchases actually have impacts.
I'm not opposed to that, but that's not the way that you change policy.
Well, actually, I think that it is the way you change policy, because if you look at history, our leaders tend to follow. They don't tend to lead in these things, and so. If you look at cruelty-free products, that was done without any legislation whatsoever. That was the consumers, the market, demanding cruelty-free products. And if you look at dolphin-safe tuna, once again, that was consumers. That wasn't done with legislation.
Actually, it was legislation.
No, when the legislators got involved, there was already dolphin-safe tuna there. When the legislators got involved, they watered down the legislation.
I see.
Same thing happened with organics. There was already organic produce out there. When the federal government got involved, they wanted to make...
Todd, you're making a great point. You're making a great point, and I can't disagree with it. And this is so much larger than these relatively small issues like, dolphin-safe tuna. I mean, we're talking about, a fundamental issue here that involves literally hundreds of billions of dollars a year.
Absolutely.
Whereas, cruelty-free products, it's a small expense for a cosmetic company.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that the American public would have been buying all these Japanese products during the Tiananmen Square massacre?
Well, actually, it's an interesting thing. I remember as a child my father telling me stories. My father was in Japan during the occupation. He joined the army during World War II, just at the tail end of it, just in time for after he got out of boot camp, the war ended. And they sent him over to Japan as part of the occupation forces. And he told me the story about how nobody in America would buy Japanese goods. And so they named a city in Japan, USA, USA, so that they could print on the products that were made there, made in USA. Right, in order to sell them here in the United States. So there was this kind of anti-Japanese sentiment for a while, but it didn't last all that long.
But I think part of the problem is we live in this culture where there's this disconnect between our consumption and the impacts of our consumption. We think it's the government's responsibility to regulate this stuff, and when we look at it, they're not regulating it.
Well, that's
pointed out to consumers.
I would say that the only people who think that are the people who think that the government's a them out there rather than an us in here.
Well,
your point is well made, Todd, and I'm not disagreeing with you. I think that we need to be doing both.
I agree with that, too, but I think that the more consumers you have getting involved in these issues and concerned about these issues, the easier it's going to be to get an industrial policy that addresses this.
I won't disagree with that at all. Well said. Jake in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jake, what's up?
hey, I really got to give it to you for saying the Reagan, Clinton, and Bush administrations with the free trade. I often hear that run over or missed in, I guess, left-leaning talk shows, and I can't hardly stand to listen to most of the right-leaning talk shows anymore, even though I am a God-fearing, gun-carrying conservative. But it's so ridiculous today when we have Martha Stewart got an ankle bracelet on, and over and over and over again, Walmart flaunts our laws in this country. A month ago, it was Moundsville, West Virginia, down here by us, and the illegal aliens being taken away.
Yep.
2 weeks after that, it was Easton, Pennsylvania, but it's not just...
Well, you know, they actually got the Department of Labor to change their policies so that they now notify them in advance before they do an inspection for illegal aliens.
This is
the Bush administration doing this.
It went on before, it goes on now, and it's not one thing. It's not them putting Huffy or Rubbermaid or Vlasic Pickles, their deals with them. They sent lawyers to the FTC hearing on China dumping televisions in this country, and it was Five Rivers Television down in Tennessee, I believe, going against Walmart's lawyers, Walmart defending them for dumping their garbage in here. And it's ridiculous, and I think the caller was basically right. It is the consumers, it's not me. You know, I mean, look at Levi's, an American icon, gone.
Yeah, they no longer make jeans in the United States. But
anymore.
The reason why Levi's built their company in the United States, and why throughout the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s Levi's continued to make their jeans in the United States rather than importing them, was because we had tariffs on imported clothing. We had tariffs on textiles. When we eliminated those tariffs, then it became a question of where's the cheapest labor, because we no longer have those tariffs protecting labor. And that has to do with national industrial policy, Jake.
Right.
Jake, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. See, I think this transcends, you know, liberal, conservative, right wing, left wing. This is all about, what is it to be an American? Are we going to put our country first, or are we going to put the interests of multinational corporations who frankly don't give a damn about this country first? And I'm telling you, our politicians, certainly the majority of the Republican Party and a healthy minority of the Democratic Party, particularly those who call themselves the Democratic Leadership Council, put the interests of the multinational corporations ahead of the interests of the United States of America. And it's a tragic thing, an absolutely tragic thing. I'm Tom Hartman. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the Democracy Zone, the radio home of democracy here at the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 6 minutes past the hour. Alec DeBrow is with us. Alec is the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ILCA, or ILCA, as they like to say over at ILCA, or ILCA, as they like to say over at the ILCA. Which is it, Alex?
ILCA.
ILCA.
Let's make it ILCA. This week it's ILCA. Let's see if that gets us any mileage.
And the website is ilcaonline.org, because somebody else had already grabbed that ILCA part, so you got to type in the online part. ILCA, ILCAonline.org. Alec, last week I raised with you the question of it was a conversation that I had earlier with one of the people in the AFL-CIO, one of the top brass folks who was responsible for international policy, saying that, you know, they weren't going to work against international treaties, trade treaties, as long as they had, you know, that they were going to fight for trade labor protections. And I was saying, you know, that's fine if you want to grow international union membership, but I'm not sure if that's the best thing for American workers. And you said you would dig into it and find out what the unions were up to on this. What have you found out?
Yeah, of course, we find out that it. I wish I could give you a simple answer, and of course there isn't. But one thing I'd said.
There rarely are in life, Alec,
a few shows ago is that there is no such thing as free trade. The question is, to whose benefit does the trade go?
Right.
And in this case, I talked to some people inside and outside the organization, and one inside said, look, it's not trade agreements per se. It's the moving of jobs. And he said, we want labor clauses because in the long run, it makes it harder, not easier, to move jobs. Now, in terms of whether you would consider these trade treaties to protect our industries, virtually no one I spoke to believes that any treaty at this point is going to protect U.S. industries. And you talked about in the early days of the Republic when there were very high tariffs, and that was true.
It wasn't just the early days. I mean, you know, we had very high tariffs right up through the 1980s. In fact, Smoot-Hawley in 1930, Herbert Hoover's attempt to pull us out of the Great Depression, dramatically raised tariffs, many tariffs, actually, up into, you know, in some cases, 20-30% range on consumer goods.
Well, apparently that worked as long as the U.S. could dominate the world economy, but the integration of it has made a huge difference. You know, today, so many U.S. Not only
but we didn't dominate the world economy, Alec. In the 1800s, we certainly didn't dominate the world economy. In fact, I would argue that we really didn't dominate the world economy even at the time of the Great Depression. We were certainly a large factor in it.
No,
but
the Smoot-Hawley was put in at that, well, actually somewhat before, and, you know, the argument is that Smoot-Hawley, in fact, contributed to the Depression itself. So,
well, what people say is that it extended it made it longer, but I disagree with that. If you go back and look at the numbers, you see that even if everybody who criticizes Smoot-Hawley was right, that what it did was it added 1-2% to the drop GDP of the United States, which is relatively small. I mean, it's not insignificant, it's relatively, even if everybody's right. But on the other hand, those tariffs stayed in place for the better part of 50 years, many of them, not all of the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, but many of them. And I would say that was to a large extent responsible for the fact that the United States became a major industrial power after World War II.
Well, that was part of it. Also, the fact that the United States had the only intact industry in the developed world.
It wasn't the only one. Yes, Europe was devastated, but, you know, number one, a lot of Europe recovered very quickly. The UK had a lot of industry. And good chunks of Asia had, well, okay.
Let me cede this point to you then.
Sure.
I'm not so much arguing the case. What I'm telling you is what the people in the organization are saying. And one is that traditionally in the post-war years, the AFL and the CIO were free trade organizations. And here's the part that you may not like. They were free trade organizations in part because they wanted to be players in the Democratic Party, which since Roosevelt had been essentially, it called itself a free trade party. The trade-off was, if they did that, they would be gaining other protections, which in fact they did. They did gain, at least to some degree, the protection of the party and were able to maintain the strength of the labor movement at that point.
That's interesting. This becomes really a fairly complex thing. At what point, you say since Roosevelt, the Democratic Party was a free trade party, free trade as envisioned by the WTO? I mean, because free trade means a lot of different things to different people.
Exactly. As I said, there is no such thing as free trade. But my understanding of it was that Roosevelt essentially ran on a free trade platform opposing the Republicans at that point.
Right, because he was using Smoot-Hawley to beat up the Republicans. I mean, a lot of the mythology about Smoot-Hawley right now, Smoot-Hawley, which I'm defending, a lot of the anti-Smoot-Hawley mythology came out of Roosevelt, came out of the Democrats in the 30s, saying that Hoover was Smoot-Hawley and a lot of his other actions to try and resolve the Great Depression made things worse.
Exactly. And it's true. I mean, these were once the AFL and CIO had the ability to be political players, they had to make these kinds of compromises that for us, standing outside, it sometimes seem weak or sometimes seem incomprehensible. Nevertheless, that seems to be the way it happened.
Interesting.
The last point is this guy inside says, look, even if we wanted to re-erect high tariff walls, who would be our political allies these days? And, you know, years ago, it was the industries themselves that backed it. Right now, you're not going to get anybody, no party, no strong organized group, no progressive group, really.
You'd have the people.
Well, but there, as an organized group, you don't have a strong lobby for protectionism. What you have is objections to the way the trade treaties are going.
I think that whoever you spoke with is misreading the will of the American people. Now, in part, I mean, we have the problem that the media is captive of these same large multinational corporations. And so outside of perhaps Lou Dobbs' program on MSNBC, you know, which is only viewed by 300,000 people a day, you know, outside of that, there is essentially no coverage, and my program, there's essentially no coverage of this left, right, in between anywhere. And Lou Dobbs, of course, is a Republican. But I suspect that politicians who go to the people and start making this argument, you know, basically the Ross Perot argument. Mm-hmm. I mean, keep in mind, Ross Perot got almost 20% of the vote just on this issue.
I understand.
And everybody thought he was nuts. I mean, you know, they thought he was a crazy old coot, and they were still willing to make him president of the United States because of this issue. So I think that, you know, if a group of politicians or a political party, and I think the Democratic Party should jump on it, was to say, hey, you know, Thomas Friedman, you know, led us down the primrose path. The Republicans have been taking advantage of this. Bill Clinton made a mistake. We're gonna say no to Evan Bayh and Hillary Clinton and the whole DLC bunch, and we're gonna go back to protectionism. And of course, they always insert the words before that, high protectionist barriers.
Barriers, yes,
you know,
of course.
Sure. I mean, I'll even give them their rhetoric if they want. They need not be high, frankly, and they need not be barriers. And certainly there are many things that we do want to have free trade on. I mean, there are many products. We don't grow sandalwood in the United States. You know, sandalwood oil from Thailand, there shouldn't be any tariff on that. For all practical purposes, there never was. I mean, that's a perhaps an extreme example, but it's one everybody can get immediately. What we should be doing is we should be saying, what industries do we want to have in this country? What areas of manufacturing are important for us to keep in this country? For purposes of national defense, and B, simply because, hey, they're good jobs, we want to keep them here, and then let's put tariffs in place that are not enough to absolutely shut down trade, but enough to slow down trade as a starting point.
Well, that's one area where I do agree with you, but the problem is that everyone in power pretends there is no industrial policy. It merely follows the invisible hand of the marketplace.
Yeah, but we do have an industrial policy, and it's turned all over to the multinationals.
Well, it does, and domestically we do in a number of ways, but nevertheless, you're right. It is very difficult to get a dialogue going on.
See, I think the unions have the ability to get that dialogue going.
Well, there is,
you know, if you want any organization in the United States who has the power, I think that Change to Win and AFL-CIO have the power to establish that dialogue. And you would, I think that they would pick up so much political steam, so much juice, so fast, and it would completely cross political party barriers.
I think you're a member of the ILCA. Why don't you write something and we'll put it up and see if we get some response to it.
Yeah, well, I am a member, and
right.
you're throwing the work back on my shoulders here, Alec. Okay. I will. I will work on that, Alec.
Okay.
I got to go to Germany this weekend, so it'll have to be the weekend after this, but I'll do it.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Yeah, Auf Wiedersehen. Alec Dubrow, ILCAonline.org, the website. Alec, thanks for being with us.
Okay.
It's always great
talking
with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace. Yeah.
Indeed. Welcome back, my friends.
Because I love America.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Thank you, Jack and Martin. It's 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, the Tom Hartman program, the True People's Radio. And in our chat room, which you can get to by going to TomHartman.com, Radio Free Philippe says, Tom, when are you going to advocate trade based on sustainability and not profit? That's my point, Philippe. When we, the people, take back our trade policy, we can be making decisions like that. But as long as we hand our trade policy over to multinational corporations through these treaties like the world, like the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Services, GATT and GATS, which create the WTO, the NAFTA, CAFTA, these sorts of things, we won't have the option of even having that discussion. We can't even have that discussion. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service is with us from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Now, I have to admit, and unashamedly, too, to taking refuge in a Caribou coffee so you can hear things in the background because it's below freezing in Washington, D.C.
Ah, well, you know, that happens. It's December.
I know, but we're all in shock. It's not supposed to happen until January.
I see. Ah, that's right. That's right. Washington, D.C. is relatively south. I've lived in the Northeast. I've lived in Atlanta. And I've lived in the Pacific Northwest, but I've never lived right there, kind of almost on the Mason-Dixon line,
I
suppose.
Yeah, no, it should be very nice. I mean, but it's really not. And so I had already had to leave the White House after the press briefing. So I thought, well, I'm going to go somewhere where I'm not chattering with my teeth. So
yeah, which brings us, by the way, to a story in today's USA Today. Heating bill bumped to hit five-year high. Homeowners to see average 25.7% jump over last season. How is it, Victoria, that we can have a 25% increase in the cost to heat your home all across the United States, and yet the government tells us there's no inflation?
Well, I don't know.
And how is it that can happen and the Republicans then come out and cut? They're cutting funding to families in the LIHEAP, the low-income heating assistance program.
I don't know. And how could it also be that middle-income people are about to get whacked probably for about $3,600 a year more tax unless unless Congress takes action to change something that's in one of the bills that's pending at the moment,
right,
which is designed to help the middle class and is about to harm them.
Yeah, you're talking about the minimum, the average minimum tax or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
It's actually not going to go. It's not that it's going to go up. It's that it's not going to go away.
Right. So people are going to get whacked probably, they think, with another $3,000. But it's possible that Congress will take some action because it's clearly not going to be popular with middle class voters.
Well, they're going to tie it to a tax cut for millionaires and billionaires and then say to people in the middle class, see what we did for you. And by the way, it's not the middle class. It's basically the middle class who earns more than about $75,000 a year.
Right. I think it's 75 to 100 and something.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it's people who are not hurting, but it's people who, you know, with housing prices and oil prices and things, they're not having a wonderful time either. Nobody's having a wonderful time. Although, having said that huge leap here, the White House seems to be very happy with the way the president's speech went today at the Council on Foreign Relations. I'm told by one of my colleagues who was there, because we're doing White House pool today, she told me that the audience was very small. It was all white men, which isn't a big surprise. But there just weren't very many of them there. There were almost more press than people in the audience. She also thought that there were a couple of places where the White House had seemed to have expected applause that they didn't get. They didn't get applause until over 30 minutes into the speech. So I think we can say that it was not a warm reception necessarily to that speech.
You think people were boycotting it?
I'm sorry?
Do you think the members of the CFR were boycotting it?
No, I don't think they were boycotting it. I just have a sense that they're not that interested. I think they knew pretty much what he was going to say, and they either buy it or they don't.
Well, for decades at the Council of Foreign Relations, they've invited guest speakers, including politicians, and there's always been question and answer afterwards. And this is a major digression from the historic tradition of the Council on Foreign Relations when George Bush said he would not take questions. And they had this huge debate internally about whether or not to accept him under those terms. They finally did, but that's pretty amazing, you know?
Well, the question was asked about that in the briefing today, about him not taking questions, and how at the Council on Foreign Relations you always take questions.
Right.
And Scott McClellan said that it had been set up from the beginning as just a speech.
No, it's not about questions or not questions. It's about George Rex, you know.
Yes, exactly. Well, we're not supposed to ask, are we?
I, Claudius, you know, it's just...
We shouldn't be asking questions. By the way, I don't know, have you ever heard the term rejectionist applied to insurgents? Because the term was used by Scott today.
Yeah, well, this is a term that George trotted out in his speech a couple days ago when he said, you know, he listed the groups of people who were fighting against, and he said the Sunni rejectionists. And he meant to imply that they're rejecting the interim government that's there. What they're really rejecting is us.
That's who they're rejecting, yes.
And
yes.
That's called an insurgency. But they don't like to use the word insurgent because people are starting to figure out what it means.
Yes, and it seems too warm and fuzzy for them, so it's rejectionist now.
Yeah, there you go. So I would say that in all probability, they've been doing focus group testing. You know, Frank Luntz has been doing his focus group testing on words again. Victoria Jones. Yeah.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Roll the dog, get me live in the moment. Don't get too far ahead, don't live in the past. I think my eyes and the moment is over. I guess another day has passed. But it's just another day.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman, the place where progressive never felt so good, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a world that works in an environment that's not going to melt us all down. Yesterday we talked with the mayor of Seattle about the political goings-on in Montreal at the big conference about global warming and the Kyoto Accords and whatnot. Today we have with us Kevin Knobloch. He's the president of the Union of Concerned Scientists, UCSUSA.org, Union of Concerned Scientists, USA.org, or UCS.USA.org, the website. And Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for asking me on.
Pleased to have you here. You are at this moment in Montreal for the conference, right?
I am indeed. It's quite a scene up here. Just a lot of energy from around the world about moving forward, and the U.S. delegation that is up here representing we Americans is doing everything they can to hold it back.
Yeah, we heard some sense of that yesterday about the politics of it. Tragically, America once again is not once again. Tragically, the Bush administration once again is not on the side of science, but is on the side of destroying the planet, basically, at the bottom line. I'm wondering, you're with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Yes.
What's the scientific information that's being presented at the conference that Americans need to know about?
Tom, the climate scientists we work with are in a near state of panic and alarm because the scientific studies coming in on global warming again and again are underscoring that the climate is already changing, that the burning of fossil fuels by we humans is a primary driver, and if we don't start to reduce those emissions, those global warming emissions, we're looking at some very, very scary future. So we're trying to make sure that science is understood by the delegates from countries around the world. This is a United Nations gathering, including the U.S. delegation.
Now, China and India are two countries that are growing like crazy, basically because we're shipping all our jobs over there, and in the process, dramatically, massively, hugely increasing their consumption of carbon-based fossil fuels. How are they reacting to all this?
Well, they are at least at the table, unlike the United States. The United States is not now a formal signatory to the Kyoto Protocol, which is the instrument that implements the treaty. So they're up here trying to gum up the works and keep the other nations from proceeding. At least China and India are at the table, and they understand that they don't have to repeat the mistakes of the way the industrialized West developed, where we pollute first and clean it up later
when
we can afford to. So China today, Tom, has a fuel economy standard for its vehicle fleet that is much more efficient than the standard in the United States. They have a national renewable electricity standard to, you know, to produce more energy from renewables. We got a national standard through the U.S. Senate, and it was blocked by the House. So say what you will about China's pace of development, and it's very serious. It could wash us over in terms of their pollutants.
Well,
they are at least stepping up to the plate.
Well, maybe. I remember back in the days of the Soviet Union that Radio Free Moscow, or the Voice of Moscow, I forget what the name of the station was now, but the Russian propaganda broadcasts used to talk about how the Soviet Union had the strongest food safety laws in the world, the strongest radiation protection laws in the world, you know, blah, 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 blah. And in fact, they did. They just never enforced any of them. You know, it was all smoke and mirrors. It was all PR. And are the Chinese actually doing something about this? I mean, I understand that Beijing is one of the most badly polluted cities in the world right now. Last time I was there was in the 80s when the biggest problem was, you know, coal-burning stoves that people had. It was before the explosion of automobiles. But my understanding is now that here in the Pacific Northwest, I'm in Portland, Oregon at the moment, that we're getting polluted air from Beijing over the Pacific.
Oh, there's no question, Tom. There's no question. And I don't mean to be, you know, to sugarcoat what's happening. It was more to point out that their economies are so hungry for cleaner energy technologies that they're moving in that direction. They also are planning to build scores of coal-fired power plants, nuclear plants. I'm not at all trying to be Pollyannish about it. But the key point here is that we and our companies in the United States, you know, our taxpayer dollars fund all kinds of research and development into efficient technologies. Our companies ought to be the world's exporter of those technologies, renewable energy, cleaner cars and trucks, more efficient refrigerators and washers, washer dryers. We ought to be the leading exporter into India, into Brazil, into China. But because our federal government, our president is holding us back, not requiring those our companies to build more efficient products, we're not going to play in those markets, and our trade deficit will get bigger.
Well, and it's not just, you know, you said requiring. I remember back in the 70s, I used to do business in Japan, and the Ministry of Industry and Trade, METI, the notorious METI, people used to say, why is it that if I buy an American car, it's going to fall apart in 5 years, and if I buy a Japanese car, it'll last 10 or 15 years, you know, or buy a Volvo, for example, or whatever, but particularly the Japanese cars. And the easy answer that a lot of people didn't realize is that METI was basically underwriting the Japanese auto industry. The Japanese taxpayers were underwriting their auto industry, and still are to some extent, to manufacture really high-quality cars. And the United States, on the other hand, we basically said to industry, hey, you're on your own. Good luck, buddy. I mean, this is what Jimmy Carter did with the solar industry back in the 80s. He said, you know, we will help you. We will give you energy credits. We will provide government-funded research, these kinds of things. The Bush administration doesn't want to have anything to do with any of this.
Well, and, you know, the irony is that you have champions of the domestic auto industry from Michigan, from other states, elected officials who have very successfully, in a well-meaning attempt, in a well-meaning effort to block the required increases in fuel economy standards. What that really has translated into is that has let our companies off the hook from innovating.
Right.
At the same time, Japan has come out with you know, second-generation hybrid vehicle technology already.
Right, although the original hybrids, again, you know, were developed with help from METI by Toyota and Honda, not to meet any standards, but because the incentives were there, the economic incentives were there.
You're absolutely right, Tom.
Seems like we need to do both carrot and stick. Yeah. We're talking with Kevin Knobloch. He's the president of the Union of Concerned Scientists, UCSUSA.org, the website. Kevin, if my understanding of the science of all this is right, it can take as much as 100 years to sink out of the atmosphere any kind of substantial, you know, 50, 80, 100 parts per billion or per million of carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide doesn't easily sink out of the atmosphere. You know, plants absorb it, but most of those plants have a relatively short lifespan. They decay and it goes back into the atmosphere. You know, coral sinks it out over, you know, long, long periods of time, but our coral is dying all around the world. I mean, isn't there more to this than just we have to stop producing this carbon dioxide? We have to figure out a way to get a lot of it out of the atmosphere?
Yes, that's absolutely right, Tom. However, we are pumping so much of it into the air today that that's the urgent we have to stem the bleeding. It's not a great metaphor, but you know, we have to shut off the emission pipes.
Right.
You know, the emissions from the first Model Ts, the carbon dioxide, the methane, and so on.
They're still with us.
Nitrous oxide are still with us because, as you point out, those emissions stay in the atmosphere for 100 years or more. And that's why what we're doing today will be borne by our children and our grandchildren. So job one is to dramatically reduce those emissions. And we have the technologies today to get there if we aggressively roll those technologies out. When we do that, though, that is going to create jobs and prosperity in this country. Your listeners in Oregon, when they roll up to the gas pump and pay $50 to fill up their mid-sized car or small SUV, half or more of that money is going overseas. Almost all of it's going out of state. If Detroit were to build that same vehicle that got half, you know, that cost half as much to fill up at the pump, which it has the technology to do, what's going to happen with that money that your listeners save? They're going to spend it locally. They're going to spend it on education and health care and taking the kids to the movies. That money gets pumped into the Oregon economy. And that has a multiplier effect that produces jobs. And that's just one example of many where, you know, Americans are twice as wasteful and half as efficient as our counterparts in Europe and Japan, which have the same quality of life, the same standard of living. That's like a tax on our businesses, a tax on consumers here that other countries don't have to pay.
So what's going to come, Kevin Knobloch, what's going to come out of this meeting in Montreal?
Well, I think that it's mostly a process meeting, Tom, but I think the main message is that the United States government is increasingly isolated from the rest of the world. You know, Mayor Nichols is up here, as you know, and as are all kinds of state and local leaders from the United States, spreading the message that there's a prairie fire of leadership across this country of innovative policies at the state, regional, and local levels. Now we need strong U.S. leadership from the top, from the president, from the Congress. And we've got to get that message coming out of this conference. We've got to get that to our leadership.
Do you expect any kind of treaty to come out of this, any Kyoto 2 or anything like that?
Well, this meeting is designed to queue up the second, you know, Kyoto 2, as you say, the deeper emission.
Kyoto expires in 2012, doesn't it?
That's right.
Yeah. So this is to queue it up to get ready for that. Okay, we're out of time here. I appreciate your time. Kevin Knobloch, the president of the Union of Concerned Scientists, UCS.USA.org. Thank you so much for being with us today, sir.
Thank you, Tom. I'll come back anytime.
Okay, good talking with you. It's 45 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program, the true people's radio, the place where smart people get their news.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Smoggy skies and fixed elections and justice strikes from all directions. People with their backs against the floor.
Welcome back, my friends.
Looking for someone to set us free. A king with fists like Muhammad Ali. The holidays are here and we're still at war.
It's 9.5 minutes before the hour. New maps show that the Earth is rapidly running out of fertile land, according to an article in today's Guardian by Kate Revuel, running out of fertile land and that food production will soon be unable to keep up with the world's burgeoning populations. The maps reveal that more than one-third of the planet's land is being used to grow crops or graze cattle. You want to get a new insight into this, by the way, go to buzzflash.com and click on my review of Dan Quinn's book, Ishmael. I think you'll find it very, very interesting. 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, our telephone number. David in Bainbridge, Washington Island, Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, David.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly,
what's
up?
Apropos to what we were talking about, the lack of jobs in this country, I've heard recently several callers, one was on Ed Schultz, so about a man named Mike from Green Bay, Wisconsin, who said he was a Republican, he's now an independent. He said, what do the Democrats stand for? All he has to do is to look at this last $50 billion measure, which was passed by the House of Representatives, cutting welfare benefits for the disabled, Medicaid, school loan program forgiveness, and food stamps.
Well, historically, you know, for 200 years, Democrats have stood for the people and Republicans have stood for corporate interests.
And they raised and they extended a $70 billion tax cut for the wealthy.
Right.
What the Democrats stand for, of course, are the things that matter to the ordinary people, education, health care. And how anyone can be confused what the Democrats stand for, they complain. Every time I've heard a Republican call into a show, he says, "You all you do is bash Bush. What do you stand for?" Well, what we stand for are things like cutting class sizes, giving teachers more pay, and having health care for everybody. I think it was on your show, it was reported that the gross national product of these countries which provide socialized health care is a smaller percentage of the health care dollar than what we spend in the United States.
Yeah, we spend roughly twice as much on a per capita basis, on per person, on health care in the United States than any other country in the world. And yet, depending on the survey you're looking at, our total quality of health care and quality of life, quality of health, is between 24th and 42nd in the world.
What they talk about, the education would be improved dramatically in our public schools if we cut half the classes in half and paid the teachers a much better wage.
Yep.
But the illustrative of the Republicans, anything that says tax increase, they're against.
Well, it's not just that, David. The Republicans are also opposed to paying the teachers more because they're unionized, and the Republicans are just absolutely hysterical about that. Anything that might add to the power of labor, you know, heaven forbid, we can't have that. David, thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. Yeah, I do appreciate it, and, you know, well said. Tom in Minneapolis, you're live and on the air. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. Regarding that caller just now, regardless what the Republicans say, the polls show that Bush and the cons are at rock bottom. 35% is the floor for any major party. Even in the depths of the Republican Great Depression in the early 30s, Hoover got 37% of the vote during the depths of the Great Depression. So that is the floor.
In the election of 32, you mean?
In 1932.
Yeah.
So that is the floor. They're at the bottom. And the reason I called was we have 10 months till the congressional elections to ensure an accurate vote count. We need to set up phase two, because phase one is complete. People get it. Two-thirds of the people want to throw the bums out. Phase one, we have convinced them. We don't need to convince them anymore. Phase two is start setting up an exit polling apparatus to make sure the count is accurate. Two-thirds of the will of the people have to be counted. That's what we need to focus on.
Yeah, and I think that, frankly, the Democratic Party should be taking the lead in making that happen, and Howard Dean should be talking to John Zogby about putting together some polls.
How about you?
Well, I don't have the means to do it, and I don't have that large a megaphone. I mean, I have written about that in Common Dreams. You know, my pieces are floating around. It's in several of my books. I talk about it on the radio program from time to time. But it's going to take a large national organization.
Brunch with ballot accuracy every week. Do something like that.
Brunch with ballot accuracy.
Something like that. It'll spread into the other local shows and maybe into the mainstream.
There you go. The problem, Tom, is that if the Democratic Party, here I'm arguing against myself, but if the Democratic Party were to buy exit polls from John Zogby, then the Republicans would say, oh, the Democrats paid for that. We really need to be encouraging the national media to go back to the exit polls.
But they've all been scared off by
the fact that their exit polls...
The only way we can do it, Tom, is through talk shows like you, where hopefully it spreads to the mainstream to get people talking, because we can't keep getting distracted by God, guns, and gays in Iraq, man. This is all just distraction.
Yeah. For buying and selling off America.
We've already convinced them. Phase one is complete.
You got it, Tom. You got it. I appreciate it. Ray in Seattle, Washington. We have a little less than a half a minute left. What's up?
I just wanted to get back to the point about retail and the sort of the whole big picture dumbing down of America. And one of your other callers was pointing out that people are not moving on from, or you were pointing out that people are not moving on from the quote-unquote Walmart-type jobs. And I think it's because that's the people who are getting attracted to those jobs are the people who don't understand that it's easy to learn a new something and go on and do a new something.
Well, I'd say, Ray, if you really and truly believe that, that you haven't hung out in much of America. I mean, it may be true in big cities, but I'm telling you, across the vast swath of this country, Walmart jobs, Walmart style jobs. I mean, you know, you might be trading a Walmart job for a Bed Baths and Us or whatever it may be. You know, if one big box for another, but. But basically, read Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickel and Dimed, and she's got a new book out too as well. And I heard a review for BuzzFlash. You know, just exactly how hard it is to get a decent job in America now. It's a major challenge, even for somebody who's well qualified. A major challenge. It's 57 minutes past the hour, 3 minutes before the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States. You know, periodically on the program, we go beyond politics to talk about, you know, those things that you thought you knew that you didn't know, or that you didn't know that you didn't know that you needed to know, or maybe you didn't know that you didn't know that you needed to know that you didn't know that you needed to know it, but do you start to know that maybe you need to know it, but you don't even know what it is, and sometimes even, you know, everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync, and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Maybe. Rob Bresnahan is with us. He writes an astrology column that's just all over the planet. Rob, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I've been getting your column in email now for, 2 years, I think. And what's your main website?
Freewillastrology.com.
Freewillastrology.com. Thank you very much. We had a different one plugged in here. Freewillastrology.com. And you also have a book out, Pronoia, the antidote for paranoia.
Believe it or not, it's true.
Yeah, indeed. I think it's a marvelous idea. The question that I wanted to ask you, Rob, is given this point in time, you know, where we are right here, right now on December 7th, 2005, you know, where the stars are, you're an expert on astrology. What are the conditions for the next week? What can we expect to happen?
Well, I think that one of the most important things is to extract from this season the essence of it, which is generosity and compassion for other people. Put aside the crass commercialism that has infected it on a large scale, and just take what you need from it, which is that which appeals to your higher nature and that which excites you in the possibility that you really like other human beings and that kindness is something that is a very good feeling for you.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, that's just kind of generally good advice, but are there any particular, for example, you know, Mercury just went direct recently. Mercury
right.
was retrograde for a couple of weeks. And, you know, that was changing how people were looking at things and doing things. Are there any particular planets in particular configurations that we should know about? I mean, this is a serious question.
I don't really practice astrology in that way, in the sense that I can make generalized predictions for the entire world. I know that some people do specialize in tying particular aspects to particular world events, but I think that's a mistake in general. I think that when astrology works, it usually works in ways that change our souls rather than our egos, and most people use astrology to appease or to appeal to their egos. So I try to stay away from that kind of prediction.
So how do you write a horoscope without that kind of information?
Well, my goal is to appeal to people rather than to large-scale events. My goal is to activate people's imaginations about what the possibilities are in their personal lives. That's really what I'm about. I'm about informing people that they have more free will than they might think that they do, that astrology, in fact, does not condemn them to a particular predetermined fate, but that they can have a lot to do with creating the life that they want. And really what I want to do is awaken people to the possibility that their imaginations are more powerful than they understand, and to give them a number of tools for awakening their imaginations.
We're talking with Rob Brezhne. Am I pronouncing it right, Rob?
That's right.
Rob Brezhne of freewillastrology.com, the website. Pronoia, where did this come from?
Pronoia is a word that was invented, coined by John Perry Barlow in 1976, but it just sort of sat there for many years, and I tried to pick it up and run with it. And it's the opposite of and the antidote for paranoia. It's a way of looking at the world that that regards reality as being on our side. The universe is friendly. The forces of life are always conspiring to give us exactly what we need, exactly when we need it. Not necessarily what we want, exactly when we want it, but what we need.
How do you say that to the folks in the Himalayas, for example, who just, you know, you've got 500,000 people homeless with snow falling around them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that my particular understanding of pronoia, which is not necessarily what other people might do, sees life as something that takes place over a number of incarnations. And at any one time in our particular life, this particular life, we may be down or we may be up, but it all works out and balances in the end. My personal suffering that I experienced, say, 4 years ago, was a low point in my life, and it was also something that was essential for me becoming a better human being.
So even if your suffering leads to your death, for example, the victims of the Holocaust, you see that as something that ultimately will have some good?
This is a very complicated subject that I wouldn't want to dismiss in some facile way in a few
sure.
words. But I do believe that we all suffer over a period of many incarnations. We suffer in various ways. And, of course, the most the central form of suffering that all of us identify with is our own deaths. And I don't mean to regard that as some little blip in our history, but it is something that happens again and again to us over and over again. And it is part of what we're here to learn about.
Don't you think a lot of people are more afraid of the pain associated with the, with death or with the loss of ego of and the extended ego of the connections, the loss of all their friends and family, more than they're afraid of death itself?
Well, I think some people are very afraid of the pain and the suffering associated with death, and some people, myself more included, are hate to contemplate the fact of our ego disappearing. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like your philosophy is very much grounded in Buddha's Four Noble Truths, you know, that all life is suffering, that that the
no,
cause of suffering is
that.
Desire. Say, go ahead.
I disagree with the notion, and I'm not sure that all Buddhists would make that statement. I've had some conversations with Buddhists in which they insist that Buddha doesn't mean exactly that, but I certainly don't believe that all life is suffering. I think that life has some suffering, but it has a lot of joy, blessings, and reasons for celebration. And
well, a solid Buddhist would tell you even that is suffering, because if you, you know, the moment that you cleave to, the moment that you try to bind yourself to either love or hate, to pain or pleasure, on either side of that duality, you're binding yourself to something, and you're setting yourself up down the road for suffering when it goes away.
Well, again, this is a conversation that we could have for a couple hours without maybe even reaching a resolution. So I don't
sure.
want to reduce it to simplicity. But my
this is talk radio.
Yeah, my understanding is that there is a way to experience joy, pleasure, generosity, compassion without being attached to it, without cleaving to it, and wanting to hold on to it forever. And in fact, that's part of what enhances the joy is celebrating the transitoriness of it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, great. Rob and your book, Pronoia, give us a little sample, a little taste of, you know, I'm not asking you to read from it, but, you know, the notions that you put forward. What's the carry-home message from your book, Pronoia?
Thousands of things go right for you every single day, beginning the moment you wake up. Through some magic you don't fully understand, you're still breathing and your heart is beating, even though you've been unconscious for many hours.
And you know, it's sort of the William Blake notion that you can focus on one thing at a time, and that you can choose to focus on what's going wrong, or you can choose to focus on what's going right. And over time, you will develop habits. And if you start intentionally making the habit of noticing what's going right, then over time you become an optimist.
Well, I think it's important that your optimism not be based on repression, though. My book, Pronoia, certainly acknowledges that there is a lot of pain and suffering in the world. And my goal is to get to the 51% mark, where we're saying yes 51% of the time. We're noticing all the things that work around us and all the things that make us feel at home in the world, 51%. And we don't lose our sense of discrimination. We don't stop criticizing what the injustices in the world, but we fill ourselves up with an understanding that a lot of things go right. And that's why I encourage people to write their own glory manifesto, which is something I have in the book. In my case, it's a 4-page stream of consciousness, a celebration of everything that I love about this life that I've been privileged to be in the middle of.
That's marvelous. Rob Bresny, his website, freewillastrology.com, his book, Pronoia. And, Rob, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Oh, thanks, Tom.
Great talking with you.
All right.
And keep up the great work. Keep writing those great, great horoscopes. They show up in the free papers all over the place. Here in Oregon, it's the Willamette Week. You see this thing. It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program, where being progressive never felt so good.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
Standing here on a highway, turned into a lake. Born on this planet that I didn't make. The ice caps are melting, you can measure the rise of the poisoned oceans, hear all the lies of the political pundits and corporate crooks, their accountants and scientists cooking the books with hardly an inkling of what it's about. Wedded to profit and flooding and drought, I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartmann radio program. In Egyptian myth, they write, Alok Ja writes in The Guardian, in Egyptian myth, Apophis, I believe I'm pronouncing that right, Apophis, Apophis, was the ancient spirit of evil and destruction, a demon that was determined to plunge the world into eternal darkness. Now, this is not a continuation on the theme of astrology with Rob. A fitting name, astronomers reasoned, for a menace now hurtling towards Earth from outer space. Speaking of news of the weird, we have several news of the weird stories here. That, you got Michael Reagan saying that Howard Dean should be hung, and we'll get to that in a minute. Anyhow, Apophis. This is a 390-meter-wide, you know, roughly 400-yard-wide asteroid discovered last year that is potentially on a collision course with the planet Earth. And scientists are imploring governments worldwide to do something about it. NASA has estimated that an impact from Apophis, which has an outside chance of hitting the Earth in 2036, is it 21 years from now, right? 21 years from now. Hopefully I'll still be around. Would release more than 100,000 times the energy released in the nuclear blast over Hiroshima. Thousands of square miles would be directly affected by the blast, but the whole of the planet could see the effects of the dust released into the atmosphere. This could be one of those nuclear winter kind of scenarios. And scientists insist there's actually very little time left to decide what to do about it. Why? Because it's going to swing by the Earth again soon, well, relatively soon, in 2029. It's going to pass close by us on April 13th, 2029. And there is a what's called a keyhole. This is the highest probability, by the way, in the history of our measuring this, which goes back 50, 60 years, of the probability of an asteroid actually hitting the Earth. 1 in 37 chance. And if it passes through this keyhole, this is a 600-meter patch of space. If it passes through this particular part of space in 2029 the right way, it will almost certainly come back, or the odds are very high, that it will come back and hit the planet Earth in 2036. And so, you know, we have to decide, what are we going to do about this in 2029 when it comes flying by? Because 7 years later, it'll be flying by again. At the peak of concern, Apophis was asteroid was placed on 4 out of 10 on the Torino scale, a measure of the threat posed by a near-Earth object, where 10 is a certain collision that could cause a global catastrophe, the highest of any asteroid in recorded history. So we've got to figure out what we're going to do about this. Apparently 2013 is also another significant year here for this. It may be a decision in 2013 whether or not to go ahead with the full-blown mitigation mission, but we need to start planning it before 2013, says Professor Fitzsimmons. In 2029, astronomers will know for sure if it poses a threat to the Earth in 2036, but by then, it may be too late to do anything about it. We have to do something by 2029, which means we have to begin planning to do something right now. Actually, this could be very good news. Can you imagine the governments of the world uniting and saying, you know, instead of fighting each other, instead of deciding, you know, who's got the right God and who's got the wrong God and who's declaring war on whose holiday and all this kind of nonsense, we ought to get together and stop this asteroid from ending planet Earth. Really, I mean, you could make the case that we don't even need to be pointing to the asteroid. This is a climate scientist right now in Montreal are saying, you know, we need to be doing this with regard to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere right now. And we've got some really serious issues out here that we should be talking about. But instead, you've got folks like the adopted son of President Ronald Reagan, Michael Reagan, running around saying, and I quote, Howard Dean should be arrested and hung for treason. Yeah, no, I'm not making this up. What Howard Dean said that causes Reagan to think that he is guilty of treason. Now, this is Michael Reagan. This is the crackpot talk show host, not the more rational son, Ron Reagan Jr. This is the adopted son who's crackpot talk show host. And that's not to paint all talk show hosts with that brush, although some people have applied that appellation to me as well. Anyhow, Dean said, this is the same situation we had in Vietnam. Everybody then kept saying, just another year, just stay the course, we'll have a victory. Well, we don't have a victory, and this policy caused the lives of an additional 25,000 troops because we were too stubborn to recognize what was happening, end quote. And for saying that, Michael Reagan says he should be arrested and hung for treason. I mean, it's just, it's the demagoguery out of these guys, you know?
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains? Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
Yeah, there you go. See, I mean, it's just, it's not one whack job, it's another. Amazing. Michael Reagan coming out against them. Hey, Michael, look up at the sky. There's an asteroid coming. 27 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Hurricane waters ravaged 7 towns, and black and brown people are left to drown, while the White House and the Emergency Management Agency ignores. Victims seek shelter in the Astrodome, and the National Guard says don't go home. The holidays are here, and we're still at war.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes before the hour. The place where reason is our lifestyle choice. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our phone number 1-866-440-8466. You can drop by our live chat room by going to tomhartman.com. Drop in and say hello. I am I've been looking for an opportunity to play this song by Jim Tour, and I guess, you know, I it's a stretch, but I could say the War on Christmas has just kind of driven me to it. The so-called right wing, this just, well, here you go. This is Jim Tour.
Why me, George?
Yeah.
What have I ever done to deserve even one of the plagues that you've sown?
Yeah, why me, George?
Tell me, George, what did I ever do for a whiz kid like you to bring chaos to my home?
Oh, we need to pray about this one.
Lord, help me, Jesus. We didn't vote for him, but we can't ignore him, I fear. He's using your name to advance his own game. Now we're in doo-doo, way up to here. Tell me, George, if there's any damn way that there'll ever be a day I can get on a plane.
Uh-oh, I'm doing that tomorrow.
Without worrying about the next maniac trying to pay me back just 'cause you're half insane. Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one. Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run. Yes, George, I hope you're having fun.
And thank you, Jim Tour, BlueCanyonProductions.com, the website where you can find that and many other great satire phrases. Alex Goldmark, our board operator and chief general engineer, cook and bottle washer, all things amazing in New York City. Alex, you just had a great suggestion. Lay it out for us.
Oh, I was just saying, every time we say the war on Christmas, it gives it more credibility. So why don't we call it their war on Happy Holidays?
And that's what they're doing,
it's
really.
It's theirs. It's not ours.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah. Well said. Well said. Yeah. Thank you,
Alex. Just an idea.
All yeah, right. Well, I think it's a great one.
There were unhappy holidays.
There you go. Okay, you got it. I will change my meme, and if I'm backsliding, please remind me. In fact, we'll just have to remind ourselves whenever we think of War on Christmas, instead we should sort of say to ourselves,
well, the shut up line has happened only once in 6 years.
You want to know what
shut
I'm
up.
Doing?
Shut up.
I'm asking you to shut up about sex.
What? Listen, you cut his mic.
No,
hey,
that's
shut up.
No,
you had your 35 minutes. Shut up.
But it is our duty as loyal Americans to shut up and shut up publicly. We expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up. Okay. So you keep your mouth shut.
In a democracy, you don't have to shut up. Speak up.
Yeah, right. Well, anyhow, so whatever we think war on Xmas, we should say their war on happy holidays. Well said. I appreciate that. Well said. 1-866-440-8466. Thank you, Alex, for that. Myrna in, you got to pronounce it for me, Myrna. What's the city?
It's Puyallup.
Puyallup. Great.
Puyallup.
I could have done something terrible with it, I'm sure, and thank you for that.
I think we all do.
Okay. So what's up?
Well, I appreciate you so much. I mean, I can't even tell you, Tom, I listen to you every morning, and I said, there's such stability in what you say, and there's such knowledge in what you say. I want you to know that I am 67 years old. I have been a political animal ever since, and I can tell you honestly, 11 years old, because our parents got us involved.
Wow,
and
that's
they,
great.
And they had us out having people sign petitions to not kill the Rosenbergs, and I know you know what that
mm-hmm.
is.
Yeah.
And as far as...
they were not successful either, by the way, tragically.
I know. Yeah. I know. So, I mean, we've been, it seems to me all my life that I've been fighting for such personal causes and also national causes, statewide causes, and we're getting to me nowhere. It's getting worse, and I can't understand
Do you really think so? I mean, at the time that Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were being, well, ultimately were put to death for espionage, I think that there was a mass hysteria sweeping this country, the McCarthy era, which is so well characterized in George Clooney's movie, Good Night and Good Luck. And yet we did recover from that to a large extent, didn't we? Didn't we get our sensibilities back?
And I don't mean that. I mean on a presidential level, even though we were fighting against Ike, we were fighting against Nixon, we were fighting against the Bushes.
Yeah.
And each time it seems to get, we get further in a hole. And my frustration level is, I can tell you, giant.
Yeah, well.
I don't know what to do other than what I am doing, which is donating to, you know, causes that I think are important and to our senators and calling the senators and writing letters. And it's just, you know, I'm saying, we keep going backwards. What is this?
Yeah, I don't disagree with you on the one hand that there has always been a challenge, because there's always been a battle. There was a battle between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson at the founding of this country over whether we, you know, what kind of nation we were going to be. And in some ways you could say Hamilton's vision of America won out, but Jefferson's idealism of America continues to animate our country, at least in our rhetoric. So I don't think the battle is ever going to go away, Myrna, because it's just you know, it's really a battle. It's a vision. It's the dispute between two visions of how a country should be run and how people should interact with each other. And,
exactly.
You know, we can psychoanalyze it all day long. We could say it has to do with upbringing or it has to do with this, that, or the other thing. It almost doesn't matter. It's always been there. You probably go back 7,000 years, it's always been there. But what we can do, aside from calling Congress, to get specifically to your question, is we can wake people up. We need to educate people.
Definitely.
We need to be sharing people information with people. We need to be telling them, hey, this is even holding up the old ideals. This is how it used to be. This is how it could be again. Can you remember that? A lot of people don't remember what it was like in the 50s and 60s. There was certainly the downside that you and I can talk about, but there was also a tremendous upside. We had a very strong middle class in this country. You had roughly 70% of the wage earners in this country who had the ability to with a single wage earner put their kids through school, buy a home, buy a car. I mean, you had the GI Bill, educated an entire generation. An entire generation went from being basically eighth grade graduates to having children who were college graduates, a significant percentage of them, in one generation, simply because the government decided to get active, because for Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, you know, pushed through the GI Bill and other progressive reforms. And so I think that it's important that we, you know, our astrologer Rob Bresny, he was talking about, you know, look at the good side. I don't want to be Pollyannish about it, but I think it's important that we do that. So,
well, and that's what I'm getting from you, is look to the positive and just keep fighting the good causes and hoping that someday they'll pay teachers, for one thing, the highest pay you can possibly get.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Our public education system in the United States right now is a train wreck, and in large part because it's part of the infrastructure of this nation that we've been ignoring for 30 years or for 25 years. And
that's for sure.
And we really need to go back to it. Myrna, thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
Yes, and thank you. I appreciate you so much.
You're welcome, and I'm so glad to be here. You know, Myrna mentioned Eisenhower, and I just, you know, every opportunity I have. Dwight Eisenhower, can you imagine if any Democratic candidate were to say, vote for me, vote for peace? I mean, the only one that I remember was Dennis Kucinich. Listen to this. This is the 1952 commercial for Dwight Eisenhower when he was running for president of the United States, the Republican Eisenhower. Arguing that he has met the heads of Europe, he knows how to negotiate with people. In other words, we get along with the Europeans. He's a guy who can get along with the Europeans. Vote for peace, folks. Well, just listen.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
Vote for peace? Vote for Eisenhower? Can you, I mean, what candidate today would be saying that? Vote for peace? Vote for Eisenhower? It's just, and he really was. I mean, that was the whole basis of his campaign was, you know, vote for peace. Eisenhower at the 64 Republican convention.
There is only one real peace now, and that is peace for all time. Now, there are three imperatives of peace. Three requirements that the prudent man must face with unblinking realism. The first imperative is the elementary necessity of maintaining our own national strength, moral, economic, and military. It is still my conviction, as I wrote in 1947, the compelling necessities of the moment leave us no alternative to the maintenance of real and respectable strength.
And then he goes on to say that we cannot squander. Well, actually, I'll play some clips. I'll play a little piece of this when we get back. This is Eisenhower, the Republican, a peacenik. Yeah, believe it or not, 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war, where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation, where the rivers run clean through the forests of green, where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, it's the Tom Hartman radio program. We were just listening to Dwight Eisenhower. This is the thing. I mean, I want to say, I had lunch yesterday with a guy who owns a mechanics shop here in town. And I said, did you know that Eisenhower ran on the platform of peace in 1958? He's like, you're kidding. I said, no, you know, you say to Republicans, please take back your party. I mean, as much as so many of us would have said, no, we're not going to vote for a Republican, even back in the 50s. This is Dwight Eisenhower, the 1964 Republican convention.
There can be no enduring peace for any nation while other nations suffer privation, oppression, and a sense of injustice and despair. In our modern world, it is madness to suppose that there could be an island of tranquility and prosperity in a sea of wretchedness and frustration.
I mean, this is a Republican president. And, I mean, you know, just coming right out and saying, you know, we have, in 1961, when he left office, saying, you know, we have built a modern industry in the United States. We never had before. A separate military industrial complex, but we have had to create one as a result of World War II and now the Cold War. He felt it was necessary. And he goes on to say,
the total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society.
This is the Republican, as he's leaving office in 1961, Dwight Eisenhower.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Also known as Halliburton.
The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
And yet we see it now lobbying like crazy in Washington, D.C.
As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government, must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren
without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
As George Bush has made it. It's, we are just tragically, desperately broke now as a result of the people who took over Eisenhower's party and drove it into the ground. This is absolutely, absolutely terrible. 1-866-440-8466. Billy in Santa Cruz. Hey, Billy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Happy freaking Christmas to you.
There you go. And happy Hanukkah to you, Billy. What's
Thanks,
up?
Buddy. Well, I just want to say that, you know, the war on Happy Holiday, you know, it's short for Happy Holy Day. The only other people that have a holy day now are the Jews. And this is just a lot of Christian states.
Well, there's the Druids.
But really,
no. I mean, there's a lot of pagans in the United States, and Yule is a holy day.
However, what the Christians are objecting to is giving the Jews any attention during their holiday. Their concept is, you know, we're dominant here, and y'all have to understand it.
Yeah, well, that was the point that I was making. I believe it was yesterday or the day before we had an interview on about this topic, and I said, isn't this really thinly veiled anti-Semitism? And I really believe that it is.
Of course it is. And so, and when I hear someone say, I won't buy in a store that doesn't say Merry Christmas, then what I know is that's a Jew-hating a-hole.
Yeah, well, yeah, okay. Thanks. I hope you guys beeped that. Yeah, Billy, thanks for the call. Larry in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Tom.
What's up?
Just watching this breaking news. Looks like we're ratcheting up the fear factor for air travelers. Got an air marshal fired a gun on the plane's jetway and shot a passenger making some kind of threatening move down in Miami.
What, just this just happened?
Yeah, it's on right now.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it's, yeah. Fear is the name of the game, Larry. It's just increasingly. And tragically, that's also part of the media. You know, if it bleeds, it leads is the thing. I mean, there are crazy people out there.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yesterday, you gave a theory of how Alito's going to be brought into the Supreme Court with this advertisement that's supposed to start up at the beginning of the year. You want to review that real quick?
Oh, yeah. Very quickly, you've got a whole bunch of different groups, some of them religious groups, some of them political groups, who are suggesting that Alito is going to save Christmas.
Well, according to the Associated Press and today's News Tribune, churches are canceling their Christmas services.
Because?
Because according to the opponents of the closure, say the congregations are bowing to secular culture.
Yeah, right. If you believe that, Larry, I've got a bridge to sell you. Larry, thanks a lot for the call. Canceling Christmas, incredible. Well, thank you for being with us today. Thank you for joining us with this program. Hope to see you tomorrow, same time, same place. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.